Hello and welcome to Don't Call It Jazz. It's KISU's very own listening hang from a jazz musician's perspective. I'm your host, Jonathan Armstrong. I'm a professor of music at Idaho State University and a professional jazz musician and composer. I'm recording tonight's episode just over a week after the brutal murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis while in police custody. And currently we're in the midst of this significant and powerful civilian uprising, these demonstrations, this unrest that has blossomed into all 50 states and to multiple countries around the world. And there's a significant dichotomy at play here from my perspective. On one hand, there's this near universal outrage and heartbreak over such a senseless and evil murder. And on the other hand, we're witnessing this significant show of solidarity, as I say, throughout the country and throughout the world, and the potential for a great awakening as our country possibly takes one step towards a more just society with more racial equity, and perhaps takes one step towards a deeper awareness of the persistent, insidious racial inequality and racial oppression that plagues us. And perhaps one small step away from the mortal sins of this country, the mortal sins of chattel slavery, of segregation, of housing discrimination, of mass incarceration, and white supremacy. And for today's show, we're going to be exploring the role that jazz musicians have played in battling systemic racial oppression throughout the years. And so this episode is dedicated to the abolitionist movement, the civil rights movement, and our current Black Lives Matter movement. All movements that have made us a more just society. And it's important to note that all of these movements were wildly unpopular in their times. You know, many people revere Martin Luther King, but not in the 1960s. If you look up polls at the time, the man was widely reviled by specifically the white community. They thought, like people think about all of these movements and the activists in these movements, that they're too upset, that they're pushing too much, that they're asking too loudly, that they're causing too much disruption in the status quo. Yet those brave activists spoke out with the passion and the righteousness because they knew that they were just. They knew that the actions that they were demanding were the right ones, not only for them, but for the whole country. And we're a better and more just country because of their bravery and their activism. So the reason I do this today on the radio is because jazz music is a Black art. We often say that it's a uniquely American art form, and that's certainly true, but it's more accurate to say that it's an African American art form. As a professional jazz musician myself, it's important for me to fully understand that my livelihood is steeped in this Black art, and I must not ever remove the humanity of the musicians from the music. I love this music. I've dedicated my life to this music. But that dedication must honor the story of the people who made it and make it. With tonight's show, I aim to tell a story of protest and anger and resilience through jazz recordings made by Black jazz artists throughout history. Because the story of Black people in this country is one of slavery, of tragedy, of disenfranchisement, of segregation, of police brutality and oppression. But it's also one of resilience and joy and beauty and courage and art and fellowship and humanity. The recordings that I play this hour are testimony of that Black experience in this country from the artist's perspective. And sometimes these artists have to shout, sometimes they have to cry, sometimes they need to play the blues, sometimes they turn to their faith. Sometimes they mourn, and we need to listen. Thank you. That's Max Roach with Let Thy People Go off his 1971 album, Lift Every Voice and Sing. The title of the album is a reference to the James Weldon Johnson poem, Lift Every Voice and Sing, that eventually became, was set to music and is known as the Black National Anthem, an incredibly beautiful, brilliant poem and song. Max Roach is an incredible figure in jazz music. He got his start with Charlie Parker and Miles Davis, and then moved on to play with Sonny Rollins and all of the jazz greats. And this album was later in his career, the 70s. You know, he got his start in the 40s and the 50s. And for it, he invited a Brooklyn-based gospel choir, the J.C. White Singers, to join this jazz ensemble. And it's just an incredibly powerful album. It's really beautiful. It has shades of expressionism and shades of gospel music. And then, of course, just incredible jazz music and wonderful solos. It's a real all-timer. And the title of the song is quite obviously a Moses reference, Let Thy People Go, Go Down Moses, the poem and gospel song. And Black people have used the story of Moses and the Pharaoh as a parable for their own lives, you know, and their own struggles. First, of course, as actual slaves, and then to describe their lot as second-class citizens in the brutal systems of Jim Crow and segregation. And so you see a lot of Moses references in civil rights era music and art. With this next song, we're going to listen to John Coltrane's composition, Alabama, from the 1964 album Live at Birdland. This composition is John Coltrane's response to the white supremacist terrorist bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church, a Black house of worship in Birmingham, Alabama, in 1963. It was this heinous crime that injured dozens and killed four Black girls between the age of 11 and 14. And there was intense national outrage over this bombing, several nights of protest and unrest in the streets of Birmingham that spread and blossomed across the country. And in fact, in those protests, two more young Black men were killed by the police. Now, they had an investigation into the bombing, and the investigation was a collaboration between local law enforcement and the FBI, and they found four very likely suspects, all affiliates with the KKK. But when the evidence was presented to J. Edgar Hoover, he put cold water on it and refused to disclose any of the evidence, formally blocking any impending federal prosecutions against the suspects. Now, the case was officially closed until the 70s, when a new attorney general of Alabama reopened the case, and they finally prosecuted one of the four men. And then it wasn't until 2000 and then 2001 that they were able to go after the other two men for the bombing. And finally, only one of the four who is still alive is in prison currently. So it took 40 years to get to the bottom of that case. This Coltrane was so devastated by this bombing that he wrote this composition as this beautiful, this heartbreaking tribute to the victims of this cowardly act of white supremacist terrorism. It's a beautiful performance, and it's also an incredible album, Live at Birdland. Here's Alabama by John Coltrane Quartet. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was the Miles Davis Quintet with the song Agitation, a Miles Davis original composition off the 1965 album ESP. This was the debut album of the new Miles Davis Quintet. The old one was with John Coltrane and Paul Chambers and Philly Joe Jones and Red Garland. This new one was with Wayne Shorter, Herbie Hancock, Tony Williams on the drums, and Ron Carter, there you heard at the end, on the upright bass. This song, I chose it because of a little-known jazz historical event. In 1959, 5 years before this recording, Miles Davis was performing at Birdland in New York City when he was taking a break between sets. This was in the summer, so apparently it was swelteringly hot. And a police officer confronted Miles Davis and told him to move on because he was leaning against an expensive car. Of course, this was his car. And Miles Davis refused, and the cop and Davis began getting into a heated argument when the other cop, the partner of the first cop, came over and just knocked him over the head with a billy club. And it knocked him down and caused a significant head wound. Davis was put in jail. He eventually made bail, and the whole thing was an acrimonious legal battle before both sides just agreed to move on from it, not giving Miles Davis the justice that he was deserved for being smashed over the head for absolutely no reason. By all accounts, and by his included, he experienced some listlessness, some years of listlessness after this. 1959 was when he released Kind of Blue. And so after that, there's definitely some excellent albums. But by his and all artists' account, he didn't really have an artistic point of view until he formed this quartet in 1964. And he talks about having to deal with that event of just being knocked over the head for no reason out of nowhere as a traumatic event, as any of us could imagine and attest to. And that anger came out sharpened with this second quintet. It's more avant-garde, it's more experimental, and there's a lot more creative intensity on these albums that I just absolutely love, including Miles Smiles and Nefertiti and this album, ESP. And this song, Agitation, to me really speaks to what the turmoil that he was going through as he was trying to process that unimaginable event of getting smashed over the head. With this next song, we're going to listen to Nina Simone and her brilliant Backlash Blues off of the 1967 album. Nina Simone Sings the Blues. The song was written in partnership with the brilliant poet Langston Hughes, who wrote the words and helped come up with the song. And in it, you hear Nina Simone personifying systematic racial oppression as a person that she addresses as Mr. Backlash.
Mr. Backlash, Mr. Backlash, just who do you think I am? You raise my taxes, freeze my wages, and send my son to Vietnam. You give me second-class houses and second-class schools. Do you think that all colored folks are just second-class fools? Mr. Backlash, I'm gonna leave you with a backlash. Backlash, I'm gonna leave you with a backlash blue. What do you think I got to lose? I'm gonna leave you with the backlash blues. You're the one who'll have the blues, not me. Just wait and see. You get that way, a little bit down. Where you are, la, la, la.
Howard Wiley with the song John Taylor off his 2010 album, 12 Gates to the City. This was Howard Wiley's Angola project that released two albums. The debut album was called simply Angola, and then this called 12 Gates to the City. This Angola project was a partnership between Howard Wiley and the ethnomusicologist Dan Atkinson. Atkinson traveled twice to the Louisiana State Penitentiary, known simply as Angola. Angola, the prison, was named after Angola, the slave plantation on which the prison was built. And that name was very darkly taken from the African nation, Angola, where the bulk of the slaves in that region were stolen. The prison was founded in 1901 and was an active plantation all the way until the 1970s, when federal and state lawmakers intervened and demanded reform. At its inception, the prison's population went from being majority white to majority black in just a few short years, as free black citizens, freshly freed from the Emancipation Proclamation, were imprisoned for minor and false charges, and then were made to toil in slave-like conditions on the prison's plantation, again, for decades after the Emancipation Proclamation. The purpose of Atkinson's visits to the prison was to collect field recordings of the prisoners singing traditional gospel vocal quartets for Atkinson's doctoral thesis from the University of Washington, which, full disclosure, I was at school with Atkinson, and he's a brilliant person and an incredible thinker and a wonderful academic, and I'm still proud to call him a friend today. He then collaborated with the celebrated saxophonist from San Francisco, Howard Wiley, to release these two albums inspired by Atkinson's field recordings and the songs that Atkinson recorded. So Wiley took those recordings, arranged them for a jazz ensemble with these absolutely brilliant albums. And I'm biased, as I said, I'm friends with Atkinson, but these two albums, Angola and 12 Gates to the City, are some of the most brilliant, brave and groundbreaking jazz albums of the 21st century. They should be up there with everything that has been released since 2000. And Wiley's playing is stunning. All the playing on the album is stunning. It's just incredible. And we had the fortune of having Howard Wiley and another band of his, Extra Nappy, up to Idaho State University 3 years ago for our jazz festival. And they just absolutely melted the place down. They're incredible humans and educators and artists. So this song, John Taylor, is a reference to one of the inmates of Angola, and so they dedicated this song to them. We're next going to listen to Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit, and then I'll talk about it a little bit after this recording.
Southern trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the south, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the tree to drop. Here's a strange and bitter cry.
That's Billie Holiday with Strange Fruit, originally released in 1939, based on an anti-lynching poem called Bitter Fruit. When Billie Holiday heard the song being performed around New York City, she desperately wanted to record it. However, her record label, Columbia Records, refused to release it, fearing financial retribution for releasing an anti-lynching song, which is worth repeating. Columbia Records in 1939 was afraid to release an anti-lynching song, and that shows you where we were. She ended up releasing it on an alternative jazz label named Commodore, and it proved to be a sensation. It sold over a million copies and would go on to be her closer on every set throughout her professional life. Unfortunately, the power of this performance of Holiday's performance of this song caught the ire of the notorious racist Harry J. Anslinger, who was the first director of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, a precursor to the DEA. Anslinger despised Holiday for her performance of this song and for her popularity and outspoken, confident demeanor in general. He would routinely write awful racist screeds against her and other black jazz musicians in official documents, in official FBN documents, and schemed openly to destroy her life. He sent agents after her numerous times to arrest her, haunted her constantly, and slowly destroyed her life by preventing her from performing and draining her finances with legal fees. This entire time, Anslinger would tell Holiday that the harassment would ease up if she only stopped performing Strange Fruit, a threat that Holiday never gave in to. She never relented and continued to perform it. Unfortunately, Anslinger did succeed in destroying her life. In 1959, Holiday was hospitalized with chronic liver and heart disease. And when Anslinger found out that she was in the hospital, he sent agents to arrest her and put her in custody at the actual hospital on suspicion of drug possession. And she never saw the light of day, dying at the age of 44 in police custody as her body slowly broke down. Now, no doubt Billie Holiday suffered from drug addiction, but it's unconscionable to have a federal agent personally determined to destroy the life of an artist, and no doubt this contributed to her demons. Anslinger spent his entire professional life, an astounding 32 years, as the head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, laying the groundwork for a sophisticated system of disrupting black communities and specifically jazz musicians, who, again, he despised. He laid all this prejudice bare in these official documents. Like I said, they would contain racial epithets, diatribes against racial minorities and black musicians and black music. This reign of terror lasted from Herbert Hoover to John F. Kennedy, five presidents in all, and Anslinger is directly responsible for this outsized focus on punishing black citizens for drug crimes and the mass incarceration and mandatory minimums and all the different laws that we have that lock up black citizens on a much more significant scale than any other citizens in our country. We're going to listen now to Charles Mingus's composition, Fables of Phobos, off of his 59 album, Mingus Aum. This is a protest composition that lambasts Arkansas Governor Orville Phobos, who called in his state's National Guard in 57 to prevent nine black children from attending and desegregating Little Rock Central High School. The Supreme Court had just handed down their decision in Brown versus the Board of Education, declaring schools should desegregate, but Phobos faced political pressure to appease his racist base and called in the armed guards to prevent these children from attending school. It's important to note how brutal segregation is to underserved communities and how widely accepted it was at the time. Faubus wasn't some rogue racist radical. In a Gallup poll conducted after this incident, 40% of all whites and over 80% of Southern whites disapproved of desegregation. They disapproved of the Supreme Court's decision, Brown versus the Board of Education. It was an unpopular decision. And it was imperative to Faubus's political future that he support this abhorrent system of racial oppression and segregation. Mingus was understandably upset and composed this song to paint Faubus as he was, a clown not worthy of respect.
Yeah.
Mingus with Fables of Fabus off Mingus Aum. Thanks for joining me today. Thanks for taking this journey with me. As I said at the top of the show, this is an essential part of the jazz experience. This is a Black art, an African-American art, and the stories of the musicians and the artists who originated the music, who innovated the music, are as important to talk about as just the sweet chord changes in the solos. The soul of the people that recorded this music is essential to understanding the music. And so in this current climate of social awakening, of understanding the mortal sins of this country, of wanting to be better, of trying to form a more perfect union through civil unrest and protest and outrage, I think it's important to look back in our history through the lens of the artist to see how they bared witness to their struggles and the racial inequality and oppression that they endured and how that can inform us today. So on this radio show, I just tried to tell a story, and I tried to tell it through the voices of these wonderful Black artists who have so enriched my life. And if you're listening to this show, I assume they've been enriching yours. We're going to close with one of the most spectacular and breathtaking performances in jazz history, in my opinion. This is Duke Ellington's composition, Come Sunday. It's the closing movement of Duke Ellington's masterwork, Black, Brown, and Beige, composed in 1942, but wasn't recorded in 1958. The full piece features several brilliant movements of inspired composition that aims to tell the story of racial existence and struggle in America, and it ends with this stunning a cappella performance of Ellington's composition, Come Sunday. The full work, Black, Brown, and Beige, has an optimistic tint, as Ellington felt the human race transcends and is oriented towards love and respect. An optimism that I sometimes share, as Kareem Abdul-Jabbar recently wrote about this current state of unrest. I'm caught between hope and history. And I'm not trying to sugarcoat anything by ending the show with this composition, as we're still enduring in a society that doesn't quite reflect Ellington's optimism from 60 years ago. But I do feel inspired by his spirit, his artistry, and this transcendent composition, Come Sunday. And I'll leave you with Ellington's words from the song, "Lord, dear Lord, I've loved, God Almighty, God of love, please look down and see my people through."
peace and comfort to every troubled mind. Come Sunday, oh, come Sunday, that's the day. Mm-hmm.